Hey, my name is Petra Cruz, and I'm obsessed with all things birth, but especially VBAC. I am a birth doula and mom who had a vaginal birth after 3 cesareans. In this podcast, we dive deep into the inspirational world of vaginal birth after cesarean. In each episode, you'll hear inspiring VBAC stories, practical tips from professionals who've championed the VBAC cause, as well as my personal journey and how it might help you on yours. From mindset shifts to evidence-based practices, you'll leave each episode feeling inspired and informed. Get ready to soak in the wisdom, embrace the strength within, and join this incredible VBAC community. This is the VBAC Junkie Podcast. All right, today I have a very special episode for you. I got to sit down with Dr. Stuart Fishbein, who is an obstetrician that practiced in the hospital for 24 years and then switched to the home birth setting and has been doing that for the last 13 years. And he works directly with home birth midwives. He travels around the world as a lecturer and advocate for reteaching breech and twin birth skills, respect for the normalcy of birth, and honoring informed consent. I am just absolutely obsessed with everything that this man has to do with birth. He trusts birth so much, and he's trying to break away from medicalized birth model. He is a wealth of knowledge. Like, if you ask him a question, get ready to be educated because he has so much to offer. Like, we talked about why some practitioners would be against you having a VBAC and some questions that you might want to ask to see if your practitioner is on board with your VBAC. So I'm not going to keep you waiting any longer. Let's dive into this episode because it is so good. How are you today?
Petra, I'm good. I'm good. It's a new year. I'm looking forward to 2024 with a lot more optimism than I was, in 2023. I think that things are beginning to change. I think there's an unsettling that's going on. I think things are getting bad enough where people will decide to correct course. And that specifically, I'm talking about the birth world. I could be talking about pretty much any topic in the world right now. I mean, things have just sort of been spiraling out of control. But the birth world, we're not doing well. I mean, I know that England just released its statistics from last year, and they had a 39% C-section rate in England. And we used to be, most of us used to think that England was a model with their National Health Service and the midwives involved and all that. And you know, they have about a 40% induction rate, and they have only 43% of women went into spontaneous labor in England in 2023. Wow. In other words, 57% either were induced or had cesarean sections or both. And it's not better in the United States. United States may be slightly better in statistics, but not in outcomes. And I just think it has to get better. And I think people are waking up. Families are waking up. Women especially are waking up to the idea that what the medical model is offering isn't what you'd expect from an expert. So, right.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, what is your personal view on why those statistics are so high? Like the induction rates and people having cesareans over spontaneous labor.
Well, there's several. The first one I would say is fear. Fear is what drives most people to do things. And the medical model is based in fear. Doctors are taught in fear. Nurses are taught in fear. We're taught to fear pregnancy as a problem or as something that needs to be treated. And then we project that fear onto the people around us. So then women begin to fear the whole problem. And once you're in a state of fear, then it's natural to lead toward interventions because the mammalian body doesn't do well when it's in a state of stress or fear. Secondly, is economics, probably the most powerful motivator of the business is the business of medicine, in that economically for those that are running the system, it's doing great and people are making money hand over foot, not the people that are actually doing the work, but the people that control things and make decisions. And so I think there's a sense of the more we do, the more we make. And I know that sounds awful and it sounds unethical, and it actually is. But it does permeate things. I don't think the individual practitioner so much makes that choice. I think they're stuck in a hamster wheel of a system where now we've got most doctors and nurses and even midwives are now employees of some major health corporation or the government. And that means that they cannot advocate for their individual patient anymore. They have to follow the rules and regs and protocols and algorithms that are put in place by those people that are running the system, who, they work 9 to 5 and they're home at 2 o'clock in the morning and they're telling you how to practice at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so it leads to a sort of a standardized set of policies that doesn't work for most people. Most people are not standardized.
Right.
I would say that very clearly. So we end up with a system that is fearful and a fear of litigation and fear of bad outcomes and financially incentivized to do more interventions. The hospital system doesn't make money when people stay home. The hospital system doesn't make money when people don't get an epidural. The hospital system doesn't make money when babies don't go to the NICU. And as harsh as that may sound, that's a reality. So, and then the last thing, the other thing too, is that the medical system doesn't like chaos. And they feel nature is chaotic because they can't predict it. You might go into labor now. You might go into labor 3 weeks from now. Your labor might be 3 hours. It might be 33 hours. We can't have somebody sitting around labor and delivery for 33 hours. We can't do that. And so they try to control things. And in the process of controlling things, they actually create more chaos. But they don't really care because it's their chaos. And they can handle their chaos, whether they have to do like England, they have to have a C-section rate where 4 out of 10 women are getting sectioned, or they have to induce you, or they have to cut an episiotomy or put forceps on you or take your baby to the nursery or all this stuff. That's the chaos that they create and they control, and they're okay with that. What they're not okay with is letting a woman do what nature intended because they have no control over that. And we all live under the idea that birth outcomes are not always going to be perfect. And when they're not perfect, sometimes, especially when there's poor communication, as that system enhances because it's a shift mentality, there's misunderstandings and then there's a fear of being sued. And so they think that if I do everything, like people, doctors are rarely sued for doing interventions. They're sued for not doing interventions. And if interventions lead to problems, they can almost always defend themselves. There's always some expert who's willing to defend them. And the hospital will circle its wagons, and it'll be very difficult for somebody to find out exactly what happened and why. So we need to think about those things before we start getting into the system altogether. I know that's a sort of a long and winding road answer, but that's why we have 30, 40% C-section rates. That's why we have poor satisfaction rates. That's why we have high infant and maternal mortality rates compared to other Western countries. We don't do well. And the people that are running the system, they're in it so deeply they don't see that. The system isn't working for the people that it's designed to take care of. There's an analogy that popped into my head and I just lost it for a second, but oh, it'll come back to me. Let's keep talking because these things
Yeah.
just pop into my head and they're in and they're out.
Absolutely.
I jokingly say my brain is like a garage. It's a mess, but it's in there someplace. You just
I
can't
love
find it. Yeah.
it. It'll pop up out of nowhere. So do you feel like that is like, or what do you feel is the number one reason why providers, or how do you like to call them, doctors, OBs,
Practitioners.
practitioners?
I don't like the word provider. It's too generic. And
Gotcha.
it actually was designed by insurance executives to demean the doctor-patient relationship. And it's now become part of the language. And so everybody uses the word provider. But it really is, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, there are many different levels, but they're all considered providers.
Definitely.
Make burger at McDonald's is a food provider. Is he the same as the chef at some 5-star restaurant? No.
Yeah,
So
no, you make a great point. So What do you feel like might be a practitioner's number one reason for possibly not wanting somebody to go through with or plan a vaginal birth after cesarean?
There's several reasons why that is. Sometimes it's policy. Sometimes it's the policy of the hospital you work at, or the group that you're involved with, or the HMO that employs you, and they don't allow it, which is a major unethical thing, because your listeners know this, that VBAC is a reasonable choice. And ultimately, even if it isn't reasonable, it, the choice still should belong to the well-informed woman. But that's, you know, that's sort of not allowed in a system that has rules that say you can't do VBAC in our hospital. Or they'll make it financially untenable for the physician in such a thing as, well, if you're going to do a VBAC in the hospital, then you have to be here in the hospital, which means you can't be in your office. It means you can't be at home to dinner with your family. It means you can't go to your kid's little league game because you have to sit in the doctor's lounge for something that's just a normal vaginal delivery. So they make it untenable. So doctors are going to say, listen, I'm getting paid $2,200 to do this. If I'm there for 13 hours or if I'm there for 45 minutes, I get paid the same. Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to? And by the way, if I do a repeat C-section, I can do it at 7:30 in the morning, be out by 8:15. Why would I want to spend, you know, 10, 13 hours of labor and take potentially more liability for the same amount of reimbursement? Another crappy incentive part of the system that incentivizes doctors to sometimes do the wrong thing. So that's one thing, is sometimes it's policy. Sometimes it's fear. Doctors may have had a bad experience once. I mean, the rate of uterine rupture, by the way, which is a terrible term. I like the word dehiscence better than that. Rupture conjures up the image of a tire sort of blowing out on a truck on the freeway. That's not what happens most of the time. Most of the time, the scar just begins to separate. And when that happens, about every one in 200 women who have a previous single low transverse cesarean section. But only about 5 to 16% of those babies will suffer a catastrophic injury. And when I say catastrophic, I do mean catastrophic. So that's 16%. If you take the higher end of that, that's 1 in 6. So the actual risk is 1 in 6 times 1 in 200, or about 1 in 1200, which is less than 0.1%. And yet hospitals are putting in policies to make it more difficult for women to have a VBAC, and even the success of VBAC in a hospital is going to be less than at home, simply because of the rules and regs that they put you under when you're there. The restrictions that you can't eat, you have to have an epidural, or you have to be monitored, or you have to stay in one place, and all those things make it less likely. Plus, you're surrounded by people who are nervous often. And again, I'm presenting the common scenario. It's not the only scenario, but it's a very common scenario. Sometimes you get a very supportive group and a very supportive team, and they have very high rates. But we did a podcast where we looked at some of the best hospitals in the country. And like the annually, Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston is considered the best hospital in the country. I think they had a 26% success rate with their VBACs.
Oh, wow.
In the home birth world, through the 12 or 13 years that I was practicing home birth, and the midwives that I knew who were, the success rate was over 90% with a home VBAC. So there's a big difference. So there's fear, there's financial incentives, there, well, and then we didn't even get to that. And then there's policy. Financial incentives are such that, again, you can be in and out really fast. The hospital makes probably 2.5 times as much money from a cesarean section as they do from a vaginal birth. They may say it's more labor intensive because you have to have an OR and stuff like that. But labor and delivery, you might be there for 15 hours or longer. And that requires a lot of personnel and a lot of time. So, but the insurance companies are still very old-fashioned. They still consider surgery to be something worth paying more for than the skill of being able to do nothing and wait for a woman to deliver vaginally. If they were to change that around, if they were suddenly to start paying twice as much for vaginal birth and half as much as they're paying for a vaginal birth now for a C-section, you'd suddenly find that VBAC, breech, other things delivered vaginally would become more in vogue. but they're not going to be in vogue until the system changes. And the system, as I said, is changing very slowly. There are changes that I can see coming, but I don't know that they'll happen in my lifetime. We'll see.
Right. And you are actually, a practitioner who worked in the hospital system and then transferred into the home setting, right? So what originally brought you into that decision?
Well, when I first came out of residency, I was a very medicalized physician. I was the crazy guy with the hazmat suit standing on the end of the broken down bed with you up in stirrups, with your legs covered in blue drapes, washing off your vulva with betadine, immediately clamping the cord, showing you this beautiful thing that you just created, then walking across the room and setting it down in the warmer. I mean, that's what we were trained to do, and we never even questioned it. I only began to question it when I began getting exposed to midwifery care. And that was simply for a mercenary reason of I was approached by midwives to take their home birth transports. And early on in my career, I just started. It was a different era back then. You didn't get a job with a salary. You built a practice from scratch. And so I said yes, and I began to see another way of doing things. And so after about 10 years in practice, I began to change the way I did things, and I started a collaborative practice with two certified nurse midwives. And it was really a good thing to have going on. It was. The midwives took care of all the normal stuff. They did the annual visits, they did the pap smears, they did the well woman visits, they did the prenatal care, they did all that stuff. And if there was a problem, like an abnormal pap smear, or somebody needed surgery, or an ectopic pregnancy, or somebody needed a cesarean section, or a vacuum delivery, or a breech or twins or something, then I would step in. And we did that for 15 years, and we had about a 7% C-section rate in our collaborative practice, taking care of all comers. Preeclamptics, hypertensive, preterm labor, whatever, advanced maternal age. Oh my God. No, we took all of those. But we were never accepted in the community. We were always sort of ostracized. We were always sort of picked on. Like they would peer review us for something that they wouldn't peer review themselves for. All that stuff. So after about 24 years in practice, it came to a point where they had been trying to get rid of us. They'd banned the midwives, they'd banned VBAC, they'd banned breech delivery, making it very difficult to obviously give honest, informed consent
Right.
to women. They were doing to me what I said earlier, what hospitals often do to doctors. They put them in a position of having to skew their counseling to conform to the hospital standards. They decided they found a way to get rid of us, and that was to not renew our privileges. So it would have been a legal battle to fight them. It wasn't because of bad outcomes. It wasn't because of, I mean, they probably didn't. I wasn't very nice to them, because I thought that they were fools and they were treating me poorly. And so,
Right.
there was that going on as well. There was a personality thing. Can you imagine that? I can't imagine that. No. They found a way to get rid of us by not renewing our privileges. So I could have either fought them legally, or I could have started to do home birth. And what encouraged me to do home birth were not only my midwife colleagues, but the women that I still had that were due in dates, but were going to be after the day that my privileges ended. And they came to me and they all said, I'll just have my baby at home. We just want to do it with you. So, even after 24 and a half years of being in practice, I had yet to be, and backing midwives that whole time, I had yet to be at a home birth. It was kind of a step for me to make that first home birth. But fortunately, they were all beautiful. First couple dozen that I did were just amazing. And we had a very low transport rate, and we had a very high success rate, and it was amazing. And so then I just took it from there, and then I got bolder as time went by, and I began doing, VBACs I never considered to be a problem. A VBAC, as I said, and you've said, is just a normal vaginal birth. It doesn't require any special skill other than doing nothing.
Right.
But I began to do breeches at home and twins at home and diabetics at home and hypertensives at home, trying to figure out, well, why do they have to be in the hospital? What is it different about their labors that makes them have to labor in the hospital? If you have a hypertensive at home, not a preeclamptic, I'm not talking about preeclampsia, I'm talking about hypertensive. And she's on medication and her blood pressure is fine in labor. That's great. And if her blood pressure starts to get high in labor, what can we do? Well, we can go to the hospital. But why does she have to be in the hospital? just because she's hypertensive, or just because she's diabetic, or just because she has a preacher twins. I understand that it makes people nervous when I say that, but that's because in some ways, there's a lack of understanding. And in some ways, it's because most of my colleagues, including myself, were taught in a fear-based world. And it's very hard to come out from underneath that umbrella and realize that there's a whole other way of looking at things, to take a step back and realize that the way mammals give birth is to be quiet, safe, unobserved. Let things go flow naturally. Eat if you're hungry. Drink if you're thirsty. Don't be interrupted. Turn off your adrenaline. Turn off your stress. Go to your primitive brain. Turn off your cortical brain. The beauty of mammals in labor is they don't really have the same sort of cortical brain that we have. We tend to think too much. Mm-hmm. And when you start thinking, you shut off your primitive brain functions.
Right. So was that hard for you going from this, you know, indoctrinated in the hospital system and then going into home birth deliveries? Was that hard for you to kind of sit back and sit on your hands at first?
Yeah, it was. It was hard to conceptualize, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I still remember an anecdotal story of one of the first births that I did in a birth center. I was with my midwife friend, Alex, and we were sitting in the living area, and the woman was in the labor room, and she was, you know, we hadn't done anything for a while, and I tried to nap on the couch. I put my headphones in and listened to my music and try to keep myself busy. And at some point I said, should we check her? And she looks at me and she goes, no, why? And I said, okay, fine. And then she starts to make little grunting noises. And I said, should we check her now? And she goes, no, why? And then eventually she starts doing things like, and then she said, okay, now you can go check her. Okay. Which now I know we don't even have to check her then either. But it was very hard for me to learn how to back off and do nothing. But it wasn't as hard as you think. And it was, like I said, it was the best thing career-wise that ever happened to me, because it freed me up to practice the way that I was trained. And I was actually very well trained. I had a good residency program. Technically, I was well trained. I wasn't well trained in the natural birth or trusting birth, but I was well trained in techniques and things. And so I had learned breech delivery. I had learned twin delivery. I had learned forceps delivery, things that aren't being taught much anymore. So I felt very comfortable doing those sort of things. But the first couple of times, you know, I looked at the midwife and I said, so how do you do this without an epidural? How do you, you know, the same questions that most of my colleagues would ask. But he learned very quickly that when you don't interfere with a woman's natural state and the mammalian model of birth, it's very rare that you have to actually intervene. And things don't change rapidly. You don't see the sudden deterioration of fetal status that you see in the hospital sometimes when a woman's been epiduralized and pitted for hours, and suddenly the baby begins to decompensate because the baby has been stressed out or hyperstimulated uterus or disconnected from its mom. And the heart rate begins to change and it makes people nervous, and they end up doing a C-section and they get a perfectly healthy baby out, but they say, great, what would you have done if this had happened at home? Not realizing that these things generally don't happen at home in a sudden way. There are rare cases of things like cord prolapse or abruption or something like that that can happen at home. And yeah, then you can have a problem. Mm-hmm. But the success rate, the satisfaction rate, the breastfeeding rate, the thing of home birth is just so much higher for properly selected women and somebody who's a confident and skilled practitioner. And we need to train more confident and skilled practitioners. And the problem now is that practitioners are being trained generally by maternal fetal medicine doctors who see all pregnancy as being a problem. That's the way they're trained. And then they're projecting their visions and fears and anxieties onto the students and doctors that they're teaching, who then go on and project it onto the next generation and also on the women. And so we've had now 3-4 generations of women who've been dissociated from what normal childbirth is. 100 years ago, 99% of women gave birth at home.
Yeah.
And yeah, there were higher morbidity and mortality then. Of course there were. But we reached a point where the scale has tipped way too far in the wrong direction. And it needs to swing back. And I think that that's what's going to happen. And podcasts like yours are going to get the word out there. and people will be able to then ask the proper questions of their physicians to determine whether or not this is a physician that fits with my values or not.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I'd love to know what questions would you suggest somebody ask their practitioner to see if that person aligns with their values, their beliefs, the way they want their birth to kind of unfold?
Well, you can ask questions, simple questions, like people always hear these questions. You could say, what's your feeling about induction? What are the indications for induction? Do you feel like induction for non-medical reasons is something that you recommend? You could ask, the silly question about what's your cesarean section rate? The problem is that doctors who have a really high one are probably not going to be truthful about that. You could ask them how they feel about allowing you to move in labor or allowing you to eat in labor. How do they feel about you not having certain tests? How does it make them uncomfortable if you go outside of their recommendation? Will they still support you if you decide, you know what, I don't really want a Tdap shot at 28 weeks. I don't really want to have an ultrasound at 36 weeks because you want to just check on the baby. I would say that the best thing that you can do for yourself if you're having a healthy pregnancy, and most women can tell if they trust their body, you can tell the baby's moving, the baby's growing, your belly's getting bigger. You don't, you want to avoid these sort of interventions that then only lead to this cascade. There are papers out there that say that if you have an ultrasound for no reason at 36 weeks, just to check the position of the baby or see the fluid or whatever else, that you have a 22% higher chance of cesarean section simply because you had an ultrasound that you didn't need. And your doctor's going to recommend it often because, one, it makes them feel more comfortable. Two, they get to bill for it. And three, they're risk averse, but they don't understand that by doing these things that they think are risk averse is that they're creating risk. Bliss and I on the podcast, we did a whole podcast about to err on the side of caution, which is a term that a lot of doctors will use. Why are you ordering this test? Well, I just want to err on the side of caution. And that it sounds like something we would all say. It sounds reasonable, but actually, if you break it down, and what does it really mean? It means to make a mistake on the side of caution. So you're making a mistake to be cautious. Is that really a good idea? And it's not.
Right. Yeah.
But,
So is there anything that you feel like a woman should absolutely get during pregnancy? Even if she's having like a very healthy pregnancy, there's been no issues, like, is there any test or procedures that we should accept no matter what?
no, there are none that you should accept no matter what. However, things that are reasonable to consider would be your routine blood draw at at your first visit or whatever, just to check your hemoglobin, to check your anemia, to check your blood type, that sort of thing, to have baseline stuff. I don't think it's worth resisting that one. The 20-week ultrasound, if you're going to have any ultrasound, it's probably the most valuable one. But you need to make sure that the person doing it is someone who's reliable and, trusting of birth, because all too often what you'll see at the 20-week ultrasound is there'll be a perfectly normal ultrasound. And maybe you had the genetic testing done, which you may or may not want to do, that thing called non-invasive prenatal test or NIPT. And that's normal. And then at 20 weeks, they'll do an ultrasound. Your baby looks perfect, but they find one isolated finding, like a dilated kidney or a little echo in the heart. And in the face of normal genetics, it means absolutely nothing. It's a normal finding. They may even say that it's a normal finding, but then they'll say something like, but I want to see you back in 6 weeks to take a look at it. And so what's the woman thinking for 6 weeks? That there's something wrong with my baby's kidney, or there's something wrong with my baby's heart, when there isn't. And so that not only maybe there at 26 weeks it'll be fine, but for 6 weeks you've been sort of bathing your baby in a little bit of anxiety, and you don't need that. So, but as a practitioner myself, I loved when my clients had a 20-week scan, because especially when I'm doing home birthing, I want to make sure that there's nothing really rare but weird that would be contrary to safe home birth, something like spina bifida, something like a abdominal wall defect, or something like that, something with the brain. I'd want to know. But Have we done deliveries where we haven't had anybody, a woman with no ultrasounds? Yeah, we have, and the babies still come out amazing. They still come out. That's fine. And then when it gets later in pregnancy, I would avoid more and more stuff because they'll want to do things to you. At 28 weeks, they'll want to recheck your hemoglobin. If you feel fine, you don't necessarily need to do that. They'll want to check you for diabetes screening. You don't need to do that. If you're eating healthy, they want to know what your blood sugar is, fine. You could succumb to that, but I wouldn't take the 1 hour after 50 grams of sweetener test. I would probably ask them if you can do a 1 hour after eating test, which is just how does Petra eat a normal meal and what does her blood sugar do after Petra's normal meal, not after 50 grams of sugar, which is not what most people would eat for lunch. I would definitely avoid a third trimester ultrasound at all costs unless they can give you a good medical indication for it, that your fundal height isn't growing or your fundal height's growing too much, or that you're developing preeclampsia or that there's some other issue that needs to be done. But just to do an ultrasound to see the baby, I know we love to do that. I mean, I love doing that. I'll give you another anecdote. When I took care of twins in the home birth world, I did scans, especially on dyed twins, at 4 to 6 weeks apart was recommended. Some women, maybe a little bit further apart, some women a little closer. But when they came in for a visit, when they weren't supposed to have a scan that day, can't tell you how many women wanted to see their babies anyway. And it is fun with twins. But again, it is a form of non-ionizing radiation. We don't really know the downsides of it. When they turn on the color Doppler, when they turn on the 3D, that's a higher frequency of this radiation. So probably not a good idea to be doing that. But the medical model doesn't look at that sort of thing. They look at it as a risk benefit, and the benefit is all on the side of doing the scan. That's one way to look at it, but it's not the only way to look at it. And the women need to be able to make that decision on what's best for them. So when we talk on this podcast like that, I can't be telling any individual woman what she should be doing with her pregnancy. I'm just throwing things out there so that people can ask questions and decide what they want to do. But your question was, is there any test that has to be done in pregnancy? No. No. I mean, I know that people will get offended when I say this, but if your dog was pregnant, how many tests do you get on your dog?
Yeah, that is true. I mean, we throw more tests at women than we do at any other animal, mammal, because we are mammals in this entire world. It's wild. But yet we still have like the worst maternal mortality rates. And we have like the most advanced technology and medications and all the things.
Oh,
So,
we spend more per capita than any other country too. And we're like 45th in the world or so, give or take a place or two on neonatal mortality and maternal mortality. There's no excuse for that. The excuse, the issue is the system. The system likes to blame the women. Oh, they're too fat. Oh, they don't eat well. Oh, they're this, that, the other thing. No, every other country has the same sort of issue. I mean, we probably have worse nutrition in America. And I know that actually, that's not even a question anymore. I was just in England, and somebody had told me about the food that's different between there and England, and some American products will not be sold in England. So I actually was at a restaurant eating some fish and chips and having a Guinness, and there was ketchup on the table. So I looked at the back of the ketchup bottle, and it had like three things in it. It had like tomatoes, tomato paste, and salt. Or something like that. And then you look at the back of a, and both were Heinz, same company. And you look at the back of a Heinz ketchup bottle in the United States, and it's got hydrogenated corn syrup and other things. It's got a bunch of other stuff in it that isn't in. Now, our ketchup tastes better. Okay. But we're eating more processed food, more GMO stuff, more. So that may be part of the issue, but it's not the reason that we have a, 32, 33% C-section rate, a 40% induction rate, a 40, it's not the reason we're 45th in the world. And especially if you're a woman of color, then you're in greater risk. I won't even go there. I was going to just briefly mention that I think that there's biases, but I don't think that any individual doctor is necessarily racist. I just think that there's less access to care, less access to prenatal care, The insurance system is all backwards. A lot of people in the poor socioeconomic class have Medicaid. And a lot of the better doctors aren't going to take Medicaid because the reimbursement for Medicaid is so poor. You just can't make a living and give care when you have to do huge volume. And because of the way reimbursement is set up, large practices have to do volume. And when you do volume, you can't give women the time that they need at a prenatal visit or the consistency of care, continuity of care that leads to a good developing a relationship of trust. When a woman knows she goes into labor and she's got one out of eight of getting her own doctor and getting a perfect stranger to take care of her in labor or a perfect stranger nurse, that after 6 or 7 hours, she may begin to like her very much. But then what happens? Then it's change of shift. And then that person leaves, and you got a new person coming up who you have no relationship with. This is not the way any mammal would give birth. Any mammal would sense that as a threat. And labor would slow down or stop. The mammal would get up, and mammal would go someplace else. And when it felt safe, it would finally go into labor again. And this way, nature ensures the best chance of survival. And our primitive brain works just like that. And we've forgotten that. I do a lecture I called What Mammals Know and We've Forgotten. And I talk about that sometimes. And we have. And if we would get back to it now, is that going to cause some problems sometimes? Yes. Are sometimes things going to get missed in that model? Yes. But I can just tell you statistically that the numbers are going to be a lot better. And I've known because, again, not just me and living in both worlds for a really long time, but having done a lot of research. And the podcast that I do with Bliss, I have to do a lot of research for that. I'm diving in. I'm reading articles. I would really willing to bet you that other than the articles that doctors are forced to read to maintain their board certification, there's not a lot of intellectual curiosity in my associates. And again, I'm stereotyping them. Stereotype means that it applies to most, not all. But stereotypes are generally true. They may be politically incorrect, but they're usually true. Right.
Absolutely. And there's so much that we need to do and continue to do to make even the slightest little change in birth overall. But for VBAC specifically, how do you feel like would be a good way for women to navigate a system that doesn't want them to have a VBAC? Like, say there's a woman and she wants a VBAC so bad, but her hospital has a VBAC ban. Her doctor says, yeah, we could do it if I'm the one that's there, but there's no guarantee. How would you suggest that she could even navigate that if she absolutely can't change insurance?
Change doctors. They can pay out of pocket if they have to.
Yeah.
It's about what you value. You've heard the wedding analogy. I'm sure everybody in the birth world now has heard the wedding analogy. Your listeners probably know what it is, but you spend a fortune on your wedding and you pick every detail, the color of the napkins, for God's sakes. But for your birth, you sign it over to some third-party payer. And it's like these are the two most important events in a woman's life, generally, not always, but generally. And when we abdicate all responsibility for it to somebody else, how would you navigate that? You can't. Now, you could go into a hospital and decline to have surgery, but you're going to run into a stressful situation at a time when you want to be a mammal that's safe, quiet, and observed. So it's not a good situation to have a normal functional labor. So these are things you need to resolve early on in your practice. I mean, early on in your prenatal care, or even before you're pregnant. Ask your gynecologist who does your pap smear, hopefully every 3 to 5 years, not every year. But ask them if they do OB, like ask them these questions when you're not pregnant. Find out if they support VBAC or breech. Find out if they, how they deal with twins. Find these things out ahead of time. You can get a lot. You'll get, you, I mean, you trust your inner, your sixth sense inside, and you'll know, this is somebody that I can relate to and get along with, or this is somebody who makes me feel worse when I leave the office. So once you, and so deal with that ahead of time. But if you find that you have a C-section with your first baby, and want to have a VBAC with your second, you need to find out what's your hospital's success rate with VBAC. What's the support system? And don't believe that you can't necessarily do it out of the hospital. You're going to have a better chance of success out of the hospital. You may not be ready for that. You may not, your husband may not be ready for that. That's true. But that's where education comes in. And that's where at least getting some care from a midwife or a consultation with a midwife to find out what that care is like and what's involved. And even collaborative care with your OB and a midwife during your pregnancy. Pay out of pocket if you have to. To just say that because you can't afford it, I don't know what you're thinking, but having a baby is not cheap.
No.
It's a huge expense. So if you can't afford to get good prenatal care, you probably really can't afford to support a baby. Now, that could be a controversial statement right there, but I'm just saying, think about it in a different way. I'm not trying to condemn people or rag on people, but you need to start thinking about this thing in a different way. Insurance is for when you have a heart attack or a car accident. Don't use insurance for basic health stuff. Don't not see a chiropractor because your insurance doesn't cover it. Don't not get your teeth cleaned or get your dentistry taken care of because you don't have dental insurance. Those are things worth paying for. And clearly, if you have to change hospitals, if you have to cross state lines, if you have to do whatever you have to do to find a practitioner who's supportive of you, because how we birth matters. How that baby is born, from it's the whole process of being born to the microbiome to the attachments that come afterwards, is very important. And I will tell you that this has been a universal finding in my practice, is when I see a woman who comes in with a breech baby for a consult, and say it's her first baby or even her second baby, but say it's her first baby, and the doctor has only given her the option of a cesarean section for breech, I will ask that woman this question, and the answer is 100% the same answer. And the question is, did the doctor who's suggesting you have a C-section for this baby ever ask you if you want more children? And the universal answer will be no, they never asked that question. Because that's not their concern of that physician. All that's concerned about that physician is getting this baby out safely, in what they think is safely, and getting a live baby in the bassinet, which is one of my favorite statements. They don't care about what happens to that baby, that baby's microbiome. They don't really, I mean, it's not like they don't care, but it's not a consideration of how you do. And certainly not about future babies, because if you do a C-section for something like breech, when there is an option for vaginal birthing, to lower the risk to that baby by a very, very slight amount, it is a very slight amount, then all you've done is put the risk downstream on all her future babies, because now you have to deal with the VBAC issue. And the same doctors who probably won't let you have a breech vaginal delivery will probably be reluctant to do VBAC either. It tends to be all or nothing. It's too bad. It's really too bad, because none of it's necessary. These are choices that belong to the well-informed woman. And the way the system works is it skews its counseling to funnel you down the path that they want you to take.
Yeah, which is really sad. And it's like it goes to my story as well, because I had what was called an emergency C-section for my first, yeah, air quotes. And for my second, I did have a partial previa. It had moved out of the way of my cervix, but I was never informed of that, and I didn't know any better. Well, I didn't inform myself, I just thought that was the way it goes. And then I had, but I was never asked like if I ever wanted to have more children. I was just told we have a VBAC van. We don't allow this at all anyways, so we don't offer this. And I don't know, I kind of wish they would have said, well, you can change insurances, you can get a different practitioner, but nothing was ever said to that effect ever. And so and then you just go down the line. Now I've had two C-sections. Okay, next one, absolutely not. Let's plan your C-section right now. It's too dangerous. We can't do a VBAC after two C-sections. We don't, there was no question about whether I wanted more children, whether I knew the risks or the benefits of either. So, yeah, the point of this is I think this is incredibly important to get this information out there so that people realize they do have a choice. Because personally, I'm a recovering people pleaser. So I didn't want to make waves. I didn't want anybody angry at me. So I just did what I was told. And we're also conditioned to respect authority type figures, which a doctor is. So, I just thought, well, they know what's best for me. And I want to put it out there that we are allowed to make our own informed decisions, whether our doctor agrees with it or not. I mean, I'm sitting here today and I've had a VBAC after three C-sections. So, and I'm not saying that is the choice, the best choice for everybody, but, I feel like as long as you are making that decision on your terms and you realize the risks and benefits and trust your gut and all those good things, like, then it should be in your hands no matter what.
Yeah, it's important when you say that it is about your choice, but along with choice comes responsibility. And the reason a lot of my colleagues don't want to offer these sorts of things is because people want to make choices, but then if things go wrong, they don't want to accept responsibility for the choices that they make. And there's a lot of patients that are like that as well, who just say, "I want to do what I want to do, but if something goes wrong, it's your fault." Okay, you know, there's a whole personality trait about that sort of thing, and there's way too much of that victimization thing going on in our culture these days, of like, "Well, you didn't tell me that this could happen." "Yeah, I did tell you this." "Well, yeah, but you didn't tell it strong enough. You didn't tell me, it's strong," and that sort of thing. You also mentioned VBAC bans when you were talking a minute ago, and I just want to reiterate to anybody listening that a VBAC ban by a hospital is completely unethical. It doesn't stand any scrutiny. What they're telling you is they're banning you from having a vaginal delivery. And there's no excuse as to why that's the case. They'll say that safety. Safety is a canard that's used to get you to do what they want you to do. But a VBAC is just a normal vaginal birth that carries with it a very small risk of a problem. But they say, "Well, we're not equipped to handle a ruptured uterus." And it's like, well, then you shouldn't be doing obstetrics at all in your hospital, because 99% of your emergency C-sections are not for ruptured uteruses. They're for other things that may be spontaneous or maybe iatrogenic, things that you caused. It could be a cord prolapse, it could be abruption, but it could be a cord prolapse because you ruptured membranes at somebody with a high eustachian for no reason. And then you do an emergency C, but you're capable of doing those. So if you're capable of doing those, then why are you not capable of doing VBAC? This, I'm telling you, it's economics guised in sheep's clothing. They make it seem like it's about safety, but it's not about safety. What's safer for the woman and the baby is to have a vaginal birth. So VBAC bans are unethical, and anyone in your community, if anyone lives in a community that has a hospital that's banning VBAC, you need to write a letter to your local newspaper, write a letter to the hospital's CEO and the board of directors, and ask them to justify a ban on ethical grounds. Because you can say this. This is from the NIH. In 2010, they had their VBAC consensus statement. And what they said was that VBAC is a reasonable choice, that about 70% of women who attempt a VBAC after one low transverse cesarean section will be successful. Now, I said it's much higher than the home setting. It's much lower than that in many hospitals. But that was the NIH saying that 70% number. So if it's 70% successful and your hospital bans it, then your hospital is telling 70% of women that they can't have something that's better for them and their baby. And that just won't hold scrutiny. That won't just stand up to scrutiny when it comes to medical ethics. And the use of coercion of any kind, including the use of the threat of child protective services, is never acceptable. And that's written in the AMA and the ACOG Code of Ethics. So every single day in every single hospital and doctor's office, and even in our space, we are violating our code of ethics by skewing our counseling to funnel people down a path, because skewing your counseling is subtle coercion, and subtle coercion is still coercion, and it should never be acceptable. Now, bias is acceptable because you can't live without bias. Every one of us has a bias. The difference is about who's honest with their bias and who's not honest. I will be very honest with you. I have a strong bias. But I'm telling you what my bias is. as I counsel you. But I'm also backing up my counseling with data and statistics and experience. But when somebody acts as a person of authority but doesn't tell you that their position is based purely on their bias or by their organizational or hospital policy, you know, if you work for a system that doesn't allow VBAC and a woman asks you about VBAC and you tell her, yeah, you can have a VBAC here, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get yelled at. You're going to lose your Christmas bonus. You may even get fired. Because you're not allowed to tell her that she has a choice of something that we don't allow.
Wow.
You know, if they mandate, you know, if they have a quota that says more people who get vitamin K or hepatitis B vaccine in the baby after pregnancy, after birth, the more your Christmas bonus will be, or your next year's salary will be based on what you bill this year, which a lot of institutions have that.
Mm.
Talk about ethics.
Wow.
They will then skew their counseling to tell you that that you have to have these things, that your baby from vitamin K, your baby could have this terrible thing and bleed and that sort of thing and bleed in its head and die.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's true. But what's the actual risk? And the actual risk is about 1 in 16,000. So no one ever asked the question, well, if vitamin K is so damn important, how come babies are born vitamin K deficient?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't nature have tried to figure out a way to give you vitamin K if it's so damn important? But maybe for 15,999 babies, it's good not to have vitamin K. Maybe they need their blood to be a little thinner in those first week of life. So it's these little capillaries and things are forming outside of the uterus and their oxygen O2 sat and their hemoglobin is changing and other things like that. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. That's not a scientific statement I just made, but yeah. Nature isn't stupid.
Right.
It, you know, nature's flawed. You know, it creates anomalies. It creates errors.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe in natural selection, it creates favorable ones too. But the idea that natural selection or nature wouldn't have designed a way to get vitamin K across to the baby. So maybe there's a reason it's not supposed to happen, but there's no money in not giving vitamin K.
Yeah.
So if I'm a hospital or I'm a drug company, what am I going to do? I'm going to encourage the use of vitamin K. And then I'm going to lobby state legislatures to make it a law. Like in some states, I think Indiana, if I'm right, it's against the law not to give your baby vitamin K.
Wow.
So why there's a law like that, I don't know. How did they convince somebody that for something that's 1 in 16,000. I mean, you can go into your local Walmart and loot $900 worth of stuff in California, and that's legal. Okay.
That's wild.
Not giving you vitamin K in a certain state is illegal? Really? So you can see the absurdity. And when they do absurd things like this, it makes you lose faith in all of their positions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how anybody trusts organized medicine or CDC or FDA. Or big pharma after what we've seen the last 3 years. And if you do a deep dive, Petra, into the books that I've read on vaccine history, you know, Moth in the Iron Lung, Dissolving Illusions, Crooked, Man-Made Disease Explained, Vax, Unvax, Turtles All the Way Down. These are books that I would strongly recommend anybody who wants to be a parent or is becoming a parent or has a young toddler to read before they just voluntarily line up their baby for the vaccine schedule. You need to know about heavy metals. You need to know about the lack of testing. And these things, the lack of science that they support, and then the science like with VBAC that they ignore.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
So they pick and choose. This is called, there's a form of cognitive dissonance where you choose the studies that support your position and ignore the ones that don't.
Yeah.
And then also you ridicule anybody that has a position that makes you uncomfortable. So, you know, people like me and probably you too, you know, sometimes you're probably a little bit more inoculated from it, but you know, we get some real vicious trolling out there.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because they had a section and they had something done and they don't want to know that it probably wasn't reasonable or wasn't right to be done. Now, in any given case, it may very well be, but they can't differentiate the fact that I'm not speaking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not speaking to any individual who's listening to your podcast right now. I'm speaking in terms so that they, like you just said, have the information to go out and make informed decisions and look things up. And if you don't have the information, you cannot have informed consent. It's
exactly
empirical.
Yes. No, you're 1000% correct. And, you know, if we don't have obviously that information readily available, there are so many places now where we can search and find them. I mean, we can even search on if people believe in the ACOG, you know, then they can search things from their database on there where they say like certain things like VBAC is even after two C-sections is a reasonable choice to make. And they give, you know, different statistics and percentages of risks, benefits, success, those types of things. So yeah, I mean, it's out there. We just have to know how to look for it. Just start looking for it.
Yeah, I mean, searching on the internet can be perilous, but yeah, I mean, listen, ACOG, as far as its academic stuff, sometimes it's not bad if you know how to interpret data.
Right.
But ACOG freely admits that 2/3 of its guidelines are based on what's called level C, or used to be called level C evidence, which is consensus opinion. Level A evidence is based on like randomized controlled trials is the best science. Level B evidence is somewhere like retrospective meta-analysis or those sort of things. And level C evidence is evidence based on what the experts think, not necessarily on any science. So they put out these guidelines, 2/3 of which are based only on opinions. And they're the opinions of medical, of maternal fetal medicine doctors mainly, because that's who's making them. And how do they see birth? We already talked about that. Mm-hmm. So they put this out there. And even though it's meant to be a guideline, it ends up becoming a benchmark for quality and being used by hospitals to set policy based on essentially no science whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the things that just the simple things that are done to you when you show up at the hospital in labor. You know, why do you pee in a cup when you get to the hospital in labor? You're not complaining of a bladder infection.
Right.
Your blood pressure is normal. You don't have preeclampsia. Why are you peeing in a cup? I'm not asking you for the answer, because the answer is simply that two reasons. One, we've always done it that way. And two, we can charge for it. You know, why are you changing into a hospital gown? What does a hospital gown signify?
You're sick.
Yeah, you're a patient.
Yeah.
Why can't you wear your own jammies or nothing? Why do you have to wear their hospital gown? Why are they drawing blood on you? Well, we have to have a clot in the blood bank because we have to know where your blood type is in case you bleed. We have to be able to transfuse. What happens if you came in with a car accident or a gunshot wound? You get transfused O negative blood and you, or whatever, or they could type and cross you very quickly. Mm-hmm. No, they send it down to the lab so they can bill for it. And no one ever thinks about it. Why do they need to know what your hemoglobin is? You know, they say, well, we have to know. Well, then how is it possible that women have babies at home?
Yes.
We don't draw their blood. We don't make them pee in a cup. We don't send blood to the blood bank. You know, we don't do any of these things. And the babies still come out. Shocking.
I know. It's weird, right?
Right. And then it goes on from there. You have an IV. Mm-hmm. Here, sign these consent forms about surgery and death and things. All right. Meanwhile, you're contracting every 3 minutes so that they don't really bear anything. You don't really get informed consent. By the way, it's important to understand that a consent form is not informed consent. People can think about that for a second in their head, what I mean by that. Because you signed something does not mean you've got informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
And then the procedures in labor. You know, you have to be monitored. You know, you have to push on your back. You have to be up in stirrups. We can only do 1 minute of delayed cord clamping because the baby will get too much blood. It's like nature didn't design it that way. That's not how it works. The baby needs to go to the warmer so that the nurse can do her things. Well, why? Well, because that's what we do. And when you try to make them, I know I'm really bashing them a lot, and I apologize for those people that aren't like this, but just as an explanation, I've witnessed this so many freaking times in my life, and I'm actually a lightning rod for stories from people like your listeners who've had this experience. So I'm sometimes I get a little bit snarky and I apologize for that. But when you ask them why, they can't tell you why. It's just the answer is often, well, that's just how we do it. And that's like a parent saying a kid who's asking them why all the time Eventually, the parent says, because I said so.
Yeah.
And because I said so never sat well with me as a kid. And I think part of it is, you know, maybe I've made more out of it than it is, but part of it is probably why I question everything, because I got the because I said so stuff all the time, because I was probably that annoying ADHD kid. They didn't call it ADHD back then. They called it, you know, hyperactivity, or I was a hyperactive kid. And, you know, the best thing that could happen for me was to go outside and play, except in Minnesota in the wintertime, it was harder to do that. So I probably drove my mom crazy, and she probably would say that a lot because I said so.
Yeah.
So when you know, in the hospital, they do things out of routine. And when you ask them to get out of their routine, it's uncomfortable for them. Sometimes it's the poor nurse is stuck between a rock and a hard place, because if she doesn't take your blood pressure every hour while you're laboring, she's going to get yelled at by the charge nurse because she didn't chart your blood pressure every hour, every 2 hours, or whatever it is that these hospitals have a protocol. But how often does a woman come in with a normal blood pressure in labor? And unless she's intervened upon, like with an epidural, or she might get hypotensive, how often does her blood pressure change to a point where something needs to be done? She's not suddenly going to become malignantly hypertensive. And if she's hypotensive, you're going to know it because she's going to feel lightheaded and faint. And then you could take her blood pressure. But to do it routinely, because the hospital system demands you do it routinely, or you have this thing on your arm that automatically is hooked to a thing that just pumps up every hour, wakes you up out of a sound sleep to pump up your arm every hour. There's no thought process in that. And when I bring stuff up like this to the system, you know, you're greeted with like drop jaws and starry eyes. They look at you like, what are you talking about? Who are you? You know, I asked residents once, I was lucky, I got to speak at a hospital in LA called White Memorial. And I got to do a lecture to the residents on mammalian birth. And I asked them afterwards, we were just chatting, and I said, so you guys still wash off the vulva with betadine before a vaginal delivery? And they go, yeah. And I looked at them, I go, why? And they looked around, and they realized that, like, well, it isn't really a sterile procedure. Why are we making it a sterile procedure? It's actually not meant to be a sterile procedure. It's better for the baby to not be a sterile procedure.
Yeah.
Mom's poop happens to get on the baby. It's actually good for the baby. Okay. I mean, we may have aversion to having poop on us, but the idea that it's sterile, so because they make it like an operation. They're in the operating room. They're covering you with blue drapes. You know, they're treating it like they're going to be taking your gallbladder out any minute. And so they prep you. This group, by the way, when I was a resident in the 80s, in the early 80s, no, when I was a medical student in the late 70s, we used to shave women.
Oh.
For a vaginal birth.
Interesting. I hadn't heard of that.
Thank God. Thank God you haven't heard of it.
Wow.
it went the way of the dodo. But yet they were doing these things. And there's still many, many things they're doing today that hopefully will eventually go the way of the dodo. But they're always coming up with new things to do. And they do them with what's called stage one thinking, Petra. They do them without actually implementing them to see that they actually do good. I love Jeff Goldblum's quote in Jurassic Park, where he says, you were so eager to see if you could that you never thought to see if you should, or something like that. I'm quoting him.
Yeah.
When they were talking about creating genetic dinosaurs and stuff like that. So right. It's the same here. They bring in fetal monitoring, hoping that it's going to eliminate cerebral palsy.
Right.
It does nothing to eliminate cerebral palsy, but it increases cesarean section rate 500%. Mm-hmm. Not only by itself, but certainly a big part of the rise in cesarean from 5% in 1970 to 32% in 2023-24. So didn't they think, like, maybe we should test this on a small test group first? No, because they wanted to sell machines.
Yeah.
GE, other companies lobbied hospitals. They lobbied Washington to make these sort of things mandatory. And hospitals bought them up. Hospitals never seen a technology they don't like. And once they buy a new machine, they have to use it.
Yeah. I know.
It's all common sense, but it's lost in the guise of safety.
Right.
I mean, you look back at old cartoons or old movies or things like the Monty Python OB sketch. We need more machines that go beep.
Yeah.
How did they know in the 70s? How were they were visionary guys, by the way. And my favorite line in that whole sketch is the end when she says, "Doctor, I think the baby's coming. What do I do?" And John Cleese says, "Nothing, dear. You're not qualified."
Yes.
It's hilarious, but it's actually true. I'm sure that one of them or something was in the birth of their child and they saw this stuff and they just said that we got to make a skit about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because it's ludicrous.
It really is. So, I love that we've touched on all these incredible things that a lot of women probably don't even realize. Like, it's wild. I mean, I know a lot of this because, I'm just so in deep in the birth world and I support women in the hospital so much that I just see this on a regular basis. But for somebody that doesn't, this could be shocking. And it is. It should be shocking because it's like we don't trust birth to unfold without somebody doing something. And I just want it to be known that it is definitely possible for nobody to touch you, to put anything on you, and your baby still comes out. In your eyes, say we're in a dream world, like this is your dream come true. What would you like to see in the way of, we'll go specific here, VBAC? How would you like to see that, kind of supported?
I would like to see normal birth taken out of the hospital. I understand that that's probably a pipe dream, not only because it's so ingrained in our system, but also because I believe that hospitals are absolutely necessary for a small percentage of women. And if you take out the normal births from them, then they won't be financially viable and they're not going to be able to do it. But I don't see the hospitals changing their policy anyway, because their fiduciary duty is to generate revenue and move people in and move people out. And the more they make restrictions on it, the more small hospitals will close, and the less choices women will have. They'll have to drive 100 miles or 200 miles from rural areas to find a hospital to give birth at. So I would like to see normal birthing out of the hospital altogether. I don't know how we can work that out to make the hospitals viable enough to keep staffed for those problems that do come in. So that I haven't really thought that through deeply yet. For as far as VBACs go, VBACs, you need to reconsider the fact that a VBAC is just a normal vaginal delivery. And I'm talking here about VBAC after one or even two. Three's great. We had a great case where we had a VBAC after three home breech water birth that was posted, last year with Raquel. Yeah, those things are the exception rather than the rule, but the people do wake up. I've had there's in my website on the testimonial page, the very last testimonial is from a woman from Ghana who had a unnecessary C-section in Ghana, from all I can tell from her history, and then was and then had the misfortune of moving to Oxnard, California, where the doctors there told her that VBAC was illegal. And I said to her and her husband, who worked for the Ghanaian embassy, very intelligent people, I said, "Did they say illegal, or did they just say it's, it's banned here at our hospital?" And they said, "No, they said it was illegal." So they were gaslit into believing that they couldn't have it, and they had a second and a third C-section. Then she figured it out like you did, and she ended up having a 5-hour labor with her fourth baby, delivering it in the birth center. And in Canadian culture, by the way, if you From what I learned from her is that if you don't have a vaginal delivery, you don't belong in the culture of women. So she was excluded from a lot of things. And so for her, not only was it a life-changing event in the way that most women experience vaginal delivery to be life-changing, but for her, it changed her life because now she could be as cruel as it seems to exclude women for not having a vaginal birth. But again, that's not, I'm not here to judge Canadian culture of women. So but I would like to see it treated as normal, and I would like because the risk of a severely bad outcome is less than 1 in 1,000 with a low trans, with a single low trans. It's about 1 in 600, I think, with two. I don't really have a number for three, but it's still less than 1%. So, but you're not going to be told that. You're going to be told all the risk of rupture is 20, 30%. That's just not, it's just not true. And so if it's treated as normal, you can have success rates as high as 90%. And by the way, You look at the C-section rate in the hospital. A woman walking into the hospital now as a first-time mom with no problems has a C-section rate of 25 to 30% just because she's pregnant. And in the home birth world, it's probably 3 to 7%, somewhere in there. And the only difference is the model by which they're cared for in the hospital versus home, and the prenatal care and all that other stuff too, the midwifery model. So think of it as not a problem. It should never be lumped in with breech and twins. They often say, "Oh, VBAC, breech, and twins." We don't do that. Well, breech and twins require a special skill, but VBAC is just saying, "Well, we don't do that." You mean you don't do vaginal delivery then? That's what they're saying. But they don't know they're saying that because it's just rolling out of their tongue. They're repeating the same thing over and over again. It's a long habit of not thinking something wrong, gives it the appearance of being right. No one stops to really think about it. When they finally do, then the change will come. And but home birth isn't for everyone. Some women they want to have the option of a hospital birth. But I need them to know that if you go to the hospital, your chance of success is less. If you get an epidural, your chance of success is even less. Now, sometimes epidurals are a godsend, and some people will go from 4 centimeters to complete in an hour after they get an epidural and they've been able to relax. All right. We hear stories about that. So again, when I'm saying things, I'm not excluding the other possibilities. But in general, epidurals increase your risk of having a cesarean section. And we did a podcast not too long ago. And we looked at the data. So I don't know if that answered your question or
No,
not. What
that
was the
absolutely. Like in your dream world, what would you like to see? So that was phenomenal. I
I would
absolutely
like to
love
see
it.
VBAC be considered a normal vaginal delivery, but I don't really like the way our system treats normal vaginal deliveries either anymore. So, I mean, as you saw in England, less than 50% of women are having a spontaneous labor. That's insane.
It is. It's very insane. So if
Yeah.
you had any like I don't know, like the best tips that you could think of to give somebody that is, VBAC hopeful, what would you suggest to them?
Doula, midwife. Trust your body. Now, again, it depends on the reason you had your first C-section. It depends on all that stuff. But in general, go a different route. Now, some people who had a C-section for their first baby did have a home birth to start and ended up having a C-section. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to not want to try that again. But your chance of success is going to be higher, and it's definitely going to be higher if you have a doula. There really is no other magic to it. Trust your body, eat healthy, think positive thoughts, don't watch the news. Don't watch horror movies. Okay. Watch romance, romance movies, watch comedies. Don't surround yourself with people who are naysayers. People who are unsupportive of you, people, family members who think that, well, I had a C-section, or my doctor's a really good doctor, go to this doctor, and who think that because you wanted to go past 40 weeks or because you did this, that there's something wrong. Don't those people are you can love them, but they don't need to be involved in your day-to-day decision making, and they certainly don't need to know your due date. Do not tell people your due date. Tell people you're due like 3 weeks after your due date so that nobody bothers you. And trust that this is nature's design. It works really well most of the time. Nature would not grow a baby inside of you that really can't get out, except in a small percentage of times. And we've made it worse. We between our nutrition, our positioning in labor, the fear that we have going on, we're doing all those things are anti-mammalian. And we need to sort of get back and remember that this was a well thought out design by whoever designed it, and to trust it. You're always going to have exceptions, and that caveat. Whenever we have a podcast like this, there's always that caveat of that the hospital isn't the devil, and that bad things are going to happen at home. That's just the case.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
you have a better chance of having good things happen if you stay away from the medicalized birth model, unless you need it. If you have a medical condition that requires it, if you have monodi twins with TTTS, if you have preeclampsia, if you have some other, I could rattle off a whole bunch of things. If you have cholestasis where the values are over 100, not just because you have itching, should you need to be delivered. But that's will be the knee-jerk response is if you start itching and they check your bile salts and it's over a certain number, they'll tell you you have cholestasis. The treatment for cholestasis is delivery. That's what I learned in medical school. That's what we're going to do. But it isn't the case. It's much more nuanced than that. And then finding a practitioner who you feel shares your values and you can trust them. And that's really the hardest thing to do when you're in the obstetrical model. In the midwifery model, there are midwives that have gone very medical now, and you'll have to sense that out too.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
I've talked enough. I think I've said enough. People have a lot to digest. There's a lot of
Okay.
homework. I gave them homework. I even gave them books to read. So,
Yes, absolutely. No, everything that you've given is like gold. So I'm so excited for everybody to come into your world, and just get to know you better, because everything that you're doing honestly is revolutionary. It might not seem like it, because it should be like just the way things are. But what you're doing is very unique, and I absolutely love everything that you're about. So, if somebody were to want to get into your world, what would be the best avenue to do that?
well, thank you, Petra. And first of all, I am in such admiration of you for seeking out your VBAC after three C-sections and then being so passionate about it that you now are putting it out on the airwaves so people can actually learn from that. To get a hold of me, my website is birthinginstincts.com. I'm at Birthing Instincts on Instagram. The Birthing Instincts podcast is on your iTunes or Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And then our website for that is, incredibly creatively enough, birthinginstinctspodcast.com. So it's like we're not very clever. And that's how you do it. I have papers that I've written on breech home birth. I'm working on getting a twin home birth paper published on home birth itself and a case report. Those are all free. They're on the homepage of my website. You just click on them, it brings up the paper online. I wrote a book called Fearless Pregnancy a long time ago. It's called Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom. And it's still, it's interesting. I wrote it when I was still a hospital-based practitioner. So it's fun for me to sort of read some of the chapters in it. But much of it is sadly still very applicable. The only chapter that's really not applicable is the genetics chapter, because that's changed dramatically since 2010. But so that book, but there's a lot of really good books out there. But anyway, that's how you reach me. I hope you follow what we're doing and spread the word to your friends about what you're doing,
Yeah.
because even if people wouldn't choose this, they ought to know it's a choice.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm going to link all of that below. I highly suggest that you listen to Birthing Instincts podcast, because everything that Bliss and Dr. Stu puts out is incredible. It's so informative, and you will definitely leave that episode, whatever one you listen to, feeling more informed and just learning something you might not have known before. So thank you so much for taking the time today, Dr. Stu. I really appreciate you.
You're welcome, Petra.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the VBAC Junkie podcast. Make sure to leave a rating and subscribe to the show so that you don't miss an episode. And also, I have a free gift for you. If you would like to have a guide on how to prepare for a VBAC, head to my website at www.birthingcometrue.com/VBAC guide. And all of this will be in the show notes, so you can just click that link and head there and download this free guide. I hope you have an amazing week. Until next time, bye.